Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
For those of you just joining us via the internet, we've been talking for about a half hour about family business here, so this morning's message might be a little bit shorter as a result. We are starting in Luke 9, verse 7. Here in Luke, we are reintroduced to Herod, and in this case, it says Herod the Tetrarch. The reason that Luke took the time to say Herod the Tetrarch is that it's not the same Herod that we heard about earlier in Luke's genealogies and in the early Matthew. We hear about Herod, that the slaughter of the innocents. That was Herod the Great. It is not this guy. In fact, as you read early in the book of Matthew, you hear that Joseph was told in a dream to take the baby and run down to Egypt. And then an angel told him to come back and said, the king that saw the child is dead. Well, that's Herod the Great. Herod the Great died. When Herod the Great died, he divided up his kingdom among his sons. And he basically gave a quarter of his kingdom to Antipas, who is this one, and a quarter to his other son, and then half to another son, which led to all sorts of civil wars between the sons. And so because he got a quarter of the kingdom, he is then a tetrarch, a quarter kingdom. I don't know that I'll read all of this, but I pulled some of this stuff off the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia this morning. The Herodians were not of Jewish stock. That's the first thing you have to know. These were not Jews, despite the fact that they were ruling over the Jews, which is why they were widely hated, and why he could, with such abandon, kill all the Jewish babies. Herod the Great encouraged the circulation of the legend that he had a family descent from an illustrious Babylonian Jew, but there's no historic basis for his claim. It is true that he was Idumean, and it is true that the Idumeans were at the time nominal Jews in practice, since they were subdued by a guy named John Hyrcanus in 125 BC. His son, Herod the Great's son, whose name was Antipater, succeeded him, and he possessed all the cunning, the resourcefulness, and the unbridled ambition that Herod the Great had had. He liked the unconquerable strength of the Roman power, and he liked the pitiable weakness of the Jews. And on these two factors, he built the house of his hopes. So he liked to emulate the practices of the Jews in order to try to look Jewish and to try to subject the Jews to his kingship. But then, at the same time, since he played both sides of the coin, he also emulated Roman life. He preferred Roman life to Jewish life. So he had followers who became known as Herodians, who lived very Greek and Roman, who acted very Greek and Roman. His emulation of the habits and the views of the Romans, in that he continually offended and defied his Jewish subjects by the introduction of Roman sports and heathen temples in his dominion. His influence on the younger Jews in this regard was baneful, and slowly a distinct party arose, partly political and partly religious, which was called the Herodian Party. Jews in outward form, but Gentiles in their dress and in their whole view of life. They were a bitter offense to the rest of the nation, but they were associated with the Pharisees and the Sadducees in their opposition to Christ. In vain, Herod tried to win over the Jews by royal charity in a time of famine and by yielding whenever possible to their bitter prejudices, but they saw him only as a usurper to David's throne, which kind of plays into the stuff we've been talking about on Thursday nights, and the heir of David and the promise of David's throne being maintained continually. There were innumerable plots against his life, but he had an almost superhuman cunning and defeated them all. He robbed his own people so that he might give gifts to the Romans, and he did not even spare the grave of King David, which the Jews held with an almost idolatrous reverence, but he robbed it of all its treasures. And the last days of Herod were embittered by endless court intrigues and conspiracies. And finally he died and his son Herod Antipas rose up. He was the son of Herod the Great and a woman named Malthus, who was a Samaritan woman. That means he was half Edomian, half Samaritan, and therefore had not a drop of Jewish blood anywhere in his veins. He ruled as a tetrarch, which means he got Galilee and the area of Perea. You can read about that in Luke 3:1. He ruled from 4 BC until 39 AD. The gospel picture we have of him is that he was superstitious, according to Matthew 14. He was fox-like in his cunning. In Luke 13, Jesus calls him that old fox. He was completely immoral. John the Baptist was brought into his life through an open rebuke of his gross immorality and his defiance of the law of Moses. And he paid for that with his life. And that's what we're going to look at this morning. At the death of his father, although he was younger than his brother Archelaus, he contested the will of Herod, who had given to the other, Archelaus, the major part of the dominion. Rome, however, sustained the will and assigned to Antipas the tetrarchy of Galilee and Perea, as it had been set apart for him by Herod, his father. He was educated at Rome with Archelaus and Philip, his half-brother, and he imbibed many of the tastes and graces and far more of the vices of Rome. His first wife was the daughter of Aretas, who was the king of Arabia, but he sent her back to her father at Petra for the sake of a woman named Herodias, who was the wife of his brother Philip, whom he had met and seduced when he was in Rome. Since the latter was the daughter of Aristobulus, his half-brother, and was therefore his niece, and at the same time the wife of his other half-brother, the union between her and Antipas was doubly sinful. You get all that? So that's why when he showed up by the Sea of Galilee, as John the Baptist was baptizing, that he looked at him and said, "It's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife as your wife." And that so enraged the king, being the sort of bad mood guy he is, that he would publicly be denounced that way by a prophet of God when he himself is busy trying to win the Jews over politically to his side. And now here is this prophet of God who the Jews are following in mass, and he's saying, "The king is in error, the king is in sin, the king is breaking the law." Well, that was bad enough that he put John in prison. And that's where our story pretty much picks up. Luke 9, starting at verse 7. "Now Herod the Tetrarch heard of all that was being done by Jesus, and he was perplexed, because it was said by some that John was risen from the dead." Now that's a very strange thing Luke does there. He just suddenly says that John, assuming you would know that was John the Baptist, has risen from the dead, as if you would already know that he had been killed. Because the circulation of the Markian letter and the Matthew letter have the stories in them about the death of John the Baptist. And the book of John does the same thing. In fact, the book of John is even more kind of flippant with that information. He just kind of glances by it and says, "And this occurred after John had died." And then he just keeps moving. And John doesn't tell us. But since John wrote sometime in the mid-90s AD and the other three letters were circulating, John assumed you knew a lot of things. Like John doesn't even mention Jesus' baptism. He just mentions that Jesus had been baptized and keeps moving because he figures you know that stuff. Luke does the same thing here, writing to his Gentile audience. So some said, "Look, John the Baptist has risen from the dead." Others said that Elijah had appeared. And others that one of the old prophets was risen again. And Herod said, "John I have beheaded. But who is this of whom I hear such things?" And he desired to see Jesus. He didn't get to finally see him until Jesus was brought before Pontius Pilate. And then when Pilate, trying to duck the political ramifications of condemning this one who the Jews saw as a prophet, to try to duck that, he said, "Well, then, if you're a Galilean, you're Herod's problem." And he sent him to see King Herod. And that was the first time Herod got to see him. Herod was disappointed in him in that he wouldn't do any miracles. He wouldn't speak. He wouldn't defend himself. Herod said, "I'm a king, and here you are supposed to be a king. Do something kingly. Do these miracles I've heard about here." Jesus refused to show off for him. So he puts a purple robe on him and sends him back to Pontius Pilate and says, "Well, it's your job to put him to death. I may be a king, but I don't have any law to put him to death." And off they go. So I find it real interesting here where he says some people were going around looking at Jesus and saying that Elijah had appeared. Why would that be? Why would people think that Elijah had appeared?
He didn't die.
Yeah, Elijah had been taken up in a whirlwind, but just as importantly, at the very back, look at the very end of your Old Testament. Just flip backwards to the very end of the Old Testament. Malachi 4. The very end of the Old Testament, Malachi 4, ends like this. For behold, the day comes that shall burn as an oven. All the proud and all that do wickedly shall be stubble. And the day that comes shall burn them up, says the Lord of hosts, that it shall leave them neither root nor branch. But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And you will go forth and grow up like calves in a stall. And you shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, says the Lord of hosts. Remember ye the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb with all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. For behold, verse 5, I send to you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. It's not insignificant that the Old Testament ends with the word curse. And at the end of the Old Testament, the very last thing that they have in their scriptures, if you take out the intertestamental books, if you take out the first and second Maccabees and some of the intertestamental books that were often packaged with what we would call the Old Testament, ends with the word curse and the promise of the return of Elijah. So the Jews were constantly watching for Elijah, waiting for him to come back. And then there was going to be the great and terrible day of the Lord. And then there was going to be the restoration of Israel. And the Messiah was going to come. But before the Messiah came in the great and terrible day of the Lord and regathered Israel, regathered Judah, and set up the kingdom that would never end, before that, Elijah would come. So here you've got this miracle worker walking around in Judea among the Jews doing these great miracles. And so naturally people are going, is that Elijah? Has Elijah come? Is the kingdom coming? Is he the king or is he the forerunner of the king? Which is why his own disciples came to him and said, why does the Bible say, why does God's word say, why do the scriptures say that Elijah will come first? And he said, if you can accept it, Elijah did come first. And then they knew that he was speaking of John the Baptist, who came in the spirit and the power of Elijah. So there's this constant Elijah connection going on here. And naturally, some would wonder whether Jesus was Elijah, or was he John the Baptist, or was he one of the great old prophets? All right, now turn backward to Mark, or if you're still in Malachi, go forward to Mark. Go to Mark 6, and we're going to read about this beheading of John the Baptist. We'll start around verse 14. King Herod heard of Jesus, for his name was being spread abroad. You have to assume that's true, by the way. The language I think you've seen throughout Luke, and now here again, is always that he has multitudes around him, as you might expect. Everywhere he goes, there are massive groups of people following him because he's doing miracles and he's feeding people and he's preaching this great word and they're following him. Well, here again it says that the reason Herod had heard of him, though he had never seen him, was because the noise of him, the story of him, was spread abroad. You got to figure everywhere in the Middle East at that time, people were talking about Jesus. Think about it for a moment. Israel is roughly the size of Rhode Island. Okay, so let's say in Rhode Island, there is a guy walking around raising people from the dead, healing every manner of diseases, driving out demons, blind people are seeing, lame are walking. Do you think that would spread through Rhode Island reasonably quickly? Sure. And wouldn't everybody in Rhode Island be trying to get to him? People will drive from California to Rhode Island to get to that guy. And that's the way it was with Jesus. For 3 years, this spread far and wide, this story of Jesus. Now, this has got to be worrisome and terrifying to Herod the Tetrarch, because Herod is the only king between Rome and these people. He's got these people completely subject to him. He's grown rich on their backs. And suddenly, either John the Baptist is back, in which case he's killed a man who rose again. That can't be good. Or Elijah's here, which means the day of the Lord is coming. Or the Messiah himself is here, in which case his kingship is pretty much over. So no matter which way you look at it, politically, this is bad for Herod. So he wants to see Jesus. And he said that John the Baptist was risen from the dead, and therefore mighty works show forth themselves out of him. Others said that it was Elijah, and others said that it is a prophet, or that it was one of the prophets. And when Herod heard thereof, He said, "It is John whom I beheaded. He is risen from the dead." Do you see how superstitious this man is? My goodness. He killed John the Baptist, and what you're going to see in a minute is that he really didn't want to. This really wasn't his choice to kill him. And now he believed that John had come back to haunt him. It was going to take away his kingship. For Herod himself, verse 17, had sent forth and laid hold upon John, bound him in prison for Herodias' sake, who was his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. For John had said to Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." Therefore Herodias had a quarrel against him and would have killed him, but she could not, because Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just man and a holy man. And he observed him, and when he heard him, he did many things, and he heard him gladly. So you can see here where King Herod seems to have some affection for John. He recognizes he's a good man, he's a holy man, and he says he observed him, and when he observed him, he heard him, and he listened to him, and he didn't have anything against him, but he did have a problem, which is that he had the evil wife. This seems to be a theme in the Bible, doesn't it? The king who would rather not until the evil wife shows up. She then says, "Oh, I want him bound and I want him killed." So here's the woman trying to kill him, Herodias, but Herod the king is saying, "No, I just can't bring myself to kill him." So she's going to get him killed through chicanery. Oh, who saw that coming? Yeah. Verse 21. And when a convenient day had come, because it was Herod's birthday, they got him a beanie, a green yarmulke beanie with a propeller on it that said, "It's my birthday." For those of you listening out there, today's my birthday. It's September 21st, 2003. I am 48 years old today. Yes, I am now officially the Ancient of Days. I know. So that's what all the joking about birthday is. So Herod, because it was his birthday, he made a supper for all his lords and his high captains and the chief estates of Galilee. And when the daughter of that said Herodias came in, she came in and danced, and the dancing pleased Herod and them that sat with him. That the king said to the damsel, "Ask what you will of me, and I will give it to you." So you get the picture? This old goat. Feeling generous. I think it's more than just generosity happening here. This old goat has the wife who he shouldn't have to begin with, and she has a daughter, and he's got his eye on the daughter. I mean, why not? He's already marrying his niece, who was his brother's wife. Now he's liking the looks of the younger girl. And so he wants to show her off to all his captains, and he gathers everybody around, throws a big birthday party for himself, and then has her come out and prance around and do a little dance for everybody so that they can all leer at her because he's the one with the best shot of actually having her. So he's just showing off the young girl. And then in order to get affection from the girl, says, "Ask anything you want, and I'll give it to you. Whatsoever you will," verse 23, "and he swore unto her, whatever you ask, I'll give it to you, even unto half of my kingdom." Well, who gets half the kingdom? The queen. So Herodias has got to be sitting over there going, "My days are numbered. Apparently my daughter will be taking over soon." But it turns out that mother and daughter had their own scheme cooking in the background. Verse 24, "And when she went forth, she said to her mother, what shall I ask? And the mother said, the head of John the Baptist. So she came in straightway with haste to the king. And she said, I will that you will give me by and by on a plate the head of John the Baptist. That can't be what he was expecting. Here he is trying to butter the girl up. I'll give you half of my kingdom. You want money, you want jewels, you want power, you want fame, I'll give you all that. She comes in and says, kill John the Baptist and bring me his head on a platter. Verse 26, and the king was exceedingly sorrowful. Yet he's sitting in a room full of all his captains and mighty men and kings, so he can't recant. He can't back up. So he was exceedingly sorrowful for his oath's sake, and for the sake of them which sat with him, he could not reject her. Verse 27, and immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded that the head of John the Baptist be brought. And he went and he beheaded him in prison, and he brought his head in a charger and gave it to the damsel, and the damsel gave it to her mother. Put flesh and blood on this for a moment, if you would. Everybody's sitting around having a party. Hooray, it's the king's birthday. Lots of drinking going on. There's music. There's the pretty girl dancing. This is all really a fun time. And then it takes a really dark turn, because an executioner has to come into that room with a dead man's bloody head on a plate, give it to the girl, and she takes it to her mom. Here, mom, I got you this. By the way, where does this girl seem to think the power is? Mom has the power. She's already figured out that dad can be manipulated. Dad's a wimp, and mom has all the power. So then she came in and gave it to her mother, verse 29, and when his disciples heard that he had been beheaded, they came and they took up his corpse and they went and laid it in a tomb. Took his headless body and went and laid it in a tomb. Isn't that something? Let me show you one more thing. I think it's in Matthew 11. Let's clear up one more thing while we're here. While John the Baptist was in prison, awaiting his beheading, he sent his disciples. We looked at this a few weeks ago, but I want to pull one particular part out of it now. A few weeks ago, we mentioned that when he was in prison, he sent disciples asking, "Are you the one that we're waiting for, or is there another?" John had sent his disciples to ask that question. And we didn't look at Matthew's account of that same question on purpose, because at the time I didn't want to get into this one particular thing, but I'm going to show it to you now, and that'll pretty much make a morning. It came to pass, chapter 11, starting at verse 1, it came to pass when Jesus had made an end of commanding his 12 disciples, he departed from there to teach and to preach in their cities. And when John the Baptist had heard while he was in prison the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said to them, "Are you him that should come, or do we look for another?" Jesus answered and said unto them, "Go and show John again those things which you do hear and that you do see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he whosoever shall not be offended in me." And as they departed, Jesus began to say unto the multitudes concerning John, "What did you go out into the wilderness to see? Did you go to watch reeds shaken in the wind? No, what did you go out to see? Did you go look for a man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they that wear soft clothing are in the king's houses. But what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yea, I say unto you, and more than a prophet. And this is he of whom it is written, 'Behold, I send my messenger before your face, which shall prepare thy way before thee.' Verily I say unto you, among them that are born of women, there has not risen a greater than John the Baptist, notwithstanding he that is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." Now look at verse 12. This is what I wanted to get to. "And from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. And if you will receive it, this is Elijah, which was for to come. He that has ears, let him hear." There's several very deep things going on right there in reference to John the Baptist. Now, I don't know how many messages I have heard in my life on the subject of prayer that have chosen to include verse 12 of chapter 11 of Matthew. They won't even take the whole phrase, the whole sentence. They'll say, "The kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force." And they'll use that to say, when you go to pray, you have to pray with that kind of, I heard a guy on the radio not 2 weeks ago talk about holy violence. The holy violence that brings down, that you have to pray unceasing till you bring down the kingdom of heaven. And the problem is, every time they see the phrase kingdom of heaven, they necessarily think that it means, that it always has to mean, heaven in the heavenly realms, the place where God's throne is. And so for the kingdom of heaven where God's throne is to suffer violence, then the only way they can deal with that is to say that that must be some kind of prayer in some sort of violent way, praying to God on his throne in the kingdom of heaven. Because again, they have narrowly defined the kingdom of heaven to only be the place where God sits. The problem with that interpretation, of course, is that it would then be, if it were true, one of the few places in the Bible where Christians are referred to as the violent, which seems antithetical to everything else the Bible says about how we ought to be, patient and kind and long-suffering and violent. You know, you don't find that among the gifts of the Spirit.
I have the spiritual gift of violence.
I have the spiritual gift of violence. Exactly. It's a holy violence. More importantly, let me give you a tool you can use here. Whenever you're listening to somebody interpret the Bible, and this is a perfect place to give an example of how to do this. Huh? Yeah, the off button on the radio is the perfect way to deal with this. Whenever you hear someone interpret a passage, see if you can encapsulate their interpretation and say the interpretation in some good encapsulation, genuinely, honestly saying what it is the interpreter is saying, and then take what they've said and plug it back into the context and see if it makes logical sense. If it doesn't make any logical sense, then you know that the interpretation was incorrect. We'll do it here as a group with that particular verse. First off, the context here is not talking about prayer at all. It's talking about John the Baptist being put in prison and about to be beheaded. That's your context. It's also about Jesus recognizing that he himself is the next one in line to be crucified, to be punished. And he talks about a very particular time frame. He says, from John the Baptist, even until now, there is a violence going on against the kingdom of heaven. So the context has nothing to do with prayer. Jesus isn't teaching prayer here, and he didn't say, when you pray, say, our Father who art in heaven, in a violent way. So it would read like this if that interpretation were correct. Starting at verse 11. Among them that are born of women, there hath not risen a greater than John the Baptist, notwithstanding he that is least in the kingdom is greater than he. And from the days of John the Baptist, when you pray, you're supposed to pray with a holy violence until you get what you've prayed for. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, and if you will receive it, he is Elijah, which was to come. Does that make any sense?
And if you don't get it, you can take it by force.
And if you don't get it, you're to take it by force. Yeah, if you don't get what you want, take it by force. It makes absolutely no sense, but that's the damage people do to a text when they take it from its context, interpret it according to what they want it to say, when they're just looking for proof text. Now, if that's true, by the way, that is the only proof text they've got that says that when you pray, you're supposed to pray with that kind of violence to get what you want. If you take that one concept out, then prayer goes back to having a much more humble and subdued sort of manner. There is no such thing as the heavenly violence of prayer, despite the multiple... Let me just ask you, has anybody else, am I the only one, has anybody else heard that verse used in the context of prayer before?
Storming the gates of heaven.
Storming the gates of heaven, violent prayer. Oh, absolutely. So if it doesn't have to do with prayer, and it doesn't, then Jesus has just said that from the time of John the Baptist, even until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers or is suffering violence, and the violent are taking the kingdom of heaven by force. Therefore, what does the kingdom of heaven mean? What is the kingdom of heaven in that phrase referring to? Can it be referring to the heavens where the throne of God sits? No, it's a direct reference to John the Baptist and his ministry. It is a direct reference to Jesus walking around on planet Earth. So when you see the phrase kingdom of heaven, it doesn't always have to mean the heavens where God sits on his throne. In this instance, he's saying the kingdom of heaven is the people of God on planet Earth who were suffering violence at the hand of violent people. And he was using John the Baptist as the example. You get that? Now that's very helpful. Because when Jesus sent his apostles out by twos and said, don't go into the way of the Gentiles and don't go into the way of any of the Samaritans, but go first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and preach the gospel of the kingdom. People, again, narrowly define gospel and narrowly define kingdom and assume that they were somehow out there preaching what? The death, burial, and resurrection that hadn't happened yet?
No, they were out.
And preach, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Now, in what way was the kingdom of heaven at hand? Does kingdom of heaven always have to mean narrowly defined the heaven coming down and the establishment of the unending kingdom. No, because he said John the Baptist was indicative of the kingdom of heaven. So if the kingdom of heaven is among you, if the kingdom of heaven is at hand, it was Jesus saying, I, the Son of God, the power of Elijah in John the Baptist, which he said in this context, are all here among you. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven is at hand among you, right here, approachable. So then the kingdom of heaven in that context, John the Baptist being indicative of the kingdom of heaven that is suffering violence and the violence taking the kingdom of heaven by force. Well, then the kingdom of heaven was very physical, wasn't it? The kingdom of heaven was, in fact, very present, wasn't it? And the kingdom of heaven actually was interacting with the evil world, and the evil world was taking the kingdom of heaven by force in a very real, very physical, very genuine, literal way. And again, that's where I get my hermeneutic from. I approach the Bible in a very literal way because if you spiritualize that language, which is the popular way to do it, no longer does the context make sense. The context disappears if you say that heaven, where God sits, was somehow suffering violence as demonstrated by John the Baptist being imprisoned and beheaded. It no longer makes sense. The kingdom of heaven was alive on planet Earth and was among the Jews and was among the lost sheep of the house of Israel because Jesus himself had breathed on them and said, "Receive ye the Holy Spirit, now go and preach." And as soon as they arrived among those people, the kingdom of heaven was at hand and among those people, which is why Jesus would say, if they accept you, they will feed you, they will clothe you, they will take care of you. And if they don't, they are rejecting the kingdom of heaven. You brush the dust off your feet, you pronounce a curse, and you leave. People say, why would they pronounce a curse and just because they rejected one of the apostles, Philip? It was because when Philip was walking around with the Spirit of God in him that was not widely available yet to the church at large until after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, then the kingdom of heaven was in fact among them in the person of Philip, just as it was in the person of John the Baptist, just as it was in the person of Jesus. And if you rejected that message, and if you were a Jew, if you were an Israelite, and you were rejecting the very real, very literal, very genuine presence of the kingdom of heaven among you, that was enough to get you cursed. So, does kingdom of heaven always have to mean heaven where God is, sitting on his throne? No, absolutely not. Or this context makes no sense. John the Baptist, that's why he's such an important figure in the early New Testament records. He teaches us all of this theology that God promised that before Christ came, Elijah would come. And John the Baptist came in the spirit and the power of Elijah, and then Jesus came. So there was the perfect fulfillment of all those Old Testament prophecies of what would happen when Messiah came. That's why they were so anticipating a physical kingdom that would come at that time on the earth, the physical kingdom that would be the restoration of the northern and southern tribes, the physical kingdom that would never be crushed, that would destroy all the other kingdoms, when Messiah himself would sit on the throne with David. All of that was being anticipated by what Jesus said here. When he said those words, the importance of it was enormous. The kingdom of heaven is here and it's suffering violence. They're going, yeah, we get it, boy, the kingdom, that heavenly kingdom, that promised kingdom, here it comes. And then he sailed off into the blue and didn't establish the kingdom. You can see why when he was standing before Pilate, and Pilate had him in bonds, and Pilate was beating him, and Pilate has him bloody and is about to put him on a tree, you can see why the people turned their back on him. He didn't establish the kingdom. He was talking about the kingdom, walking around talking about kingdom, and he didn't establish the kingdom. And then he rises up, and the last thing that they ask him is, will you restore the kingdom to Israel at this time? And he says, no, not yet, and he sails off. It's not for you to know the times and the seasons that the Father has placed in his own hands. Still talking about the same kingdom. The kingdom language hasn't changed. And off he goes. So when he comes back, what's he coming back to do? Establish the kingdom. Or else the whole Old Testament lied. And the kingdom of heaven was very real and very present in the person of Jesus and John the Baptist. And the kingdom of heaven at that time suffered violence, and the violent took it by force. But when he comes back, he's the force, and they suffer the violence. When he comes back in the great and terrible day of the Lord, with the armies of his saints on white horses wearing white robes that they got at the marriage supper of the Lamb, that would be us. And he comes back, and now they suffer the violence. And they're going to pay for that. They're going to pay for the violence they did to the kingdom of heaven while Jesus was on the planet. Yes?
Okay. If we're citizens of the kingdom of heaven, right? I mean, is that fair to say?
If you know what?
Christians are citizens of the kingdom of heaven.
Because that language isn't used anywhere in the Bible, and they don't talk about or define what a citizen in the kingdom of heaven is, it'd be impossible for me to say yes or no to that question. However, because we have the Holy Spirit of God in us, we are the church, we are the bride of Christ.
Right.
And when he establishes his kingdom on earth, we come back with him and we rule and reign over Gentile nations with him. So given all that, I could say, well, yes, we will be citizens of the kingdom of heaven.
Well, okay, however that ends up, yes, okay, that's cool, that's great.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the whole restoration of Israel thing, calling them back, is taking people who are citizens of Israel and reestablishing them there.
Right.
So I'm saying in the same way, it's kind of like a picture of what is happening coming down from heaven too.
Yeah.
I guess I was thinking of the whole Ephesians 2 thing.
I mean, I know that this will make me very, very dispensational, and I understand that. But if you can't see the differences through all of this between restoring Israel and restoring the physical kingdom, which is what the promise continues to be, and all I'm pointing out here is that Jesus continues to use that language. And people spiritualize it on purpose in order to get rid of Israel's promises, but they're still Israel's promises, and either God told the truth or he didn't. And the church is a separate entity from that, is my point. The church of the Gentiles, when the times of the Gentiles are closed, according to Romans 11, then he regrafts back the wild olive branches that have been scattered, and he then concludes all Israel will be saved.
It makes perfect sense that when he comes to establish his kingdom, he's bringing everybody into his kingdom, including Israel and
his church. And we come back with him,
yeah.
And he reestablishes them on the earth, and there you go. Yeah. And so...
Like that, well, I'll just click for me. That's what he's doing when he establishes the kingdom. It's not... putting up a throne necessarily.
That, it's more than just that. It's bringing together the people who had been promised a kingdom.
Yeah.
Right. That's the only way to let the Bible keep saying what the Bible says.
Yeah.
And that's where I get that whole theology, despite the fact that people will say, well, then you're dispensational. Well, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
What I am is a biblicist, and it says all that.
Yeah.
So what I want you to get out of bringing you over here to Matthew 11 is that the kingdom of heaven doesn't always mean up in the skies, woo, 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 angels flying around, God on his throne. I'm sorry, woo, 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 God on his throne. That it does, at least in this instance, in a very physical, very real way, mean the people who were part of the kingdom of heaven walking on planet Earth. They are the ones who suffered the violence. You get that? Okay. Back to Luke. Okay, Bible trivia time. Carol, you don't get to answer this question. Because Carol sent me one time, she was emailing me Bible trivia questions one day during work because she was trying to stump me. And she was, I don't know where she was getting her questions. She was asking all these Bible trivia questions to see if I could come up with them. And one of the questions she asked me was, what's the only story that shows up in all four Gospels? Do you know what it is? There's only one story that appears in all four Gospels, and they all tell the story. What is it, Jeff?
Is it the 5,000?
Is it what?
I was thinking the feeding.
It's the feeding of the 5,000. Shows up in all four Gospels. And that's what's coming up next. If you had just read ahead a little bit, you would have known. Wow, you saved it, Jeff. You looked good. On tape and everything, you looked smart. You looked down and read, right?
That's the next heading.
That must be what Jim's heading for. So that's what we're going to pick up next week. We're going to pick up at the feeding of the 5,000. The feeding of the 5,000... also has one of the best internal indices of honesty on the part of the reporters that you're going to find anywhere in the Bible. So I'll show you that next week. They each give you little pieces of detail, and when you compare them, their detail all coincides perfectly, which again gives you that sense, that proof, that evidentiary proof that they all told the truth or else their facts wouldn't all line up. So the fact that they all four tell the same story is actually very helpful as well. So we'll pick up there because I know everybody wants cake and ice cream and, you know, the birthday party continues. So thank you for being here this morning and thank you for your patience and thank you for the hat that I will never wear again.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.